Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Hey, today my guest is Kelsey Hightower, technologist at Google. Kelsey, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Kelsey, I know you as the Kubernetes guy. I don't know if you consider yourself the Kubernetes guy, but I think me and a lot of other people do. So my first question for you is, how long have you been working with Kubernetes and what led you to get involved in this kind of stuff?
Yeah, so I think it's been over 5 years. So I think at this stage of my career, there are a lot of people who've gotten to know me through my work in Kubernetes. I've been at Google for about 4.5 years, but I was helping contribute in the early days of Kubernetes. And a lot of interactions I've had with people has either been through the documentations I've produced, or maybe they see me giving a talk, or maybe some utility that I built around the space. And also, there's a book I co-authored called Kubernetes Up and Running, so people may know me from that, but it's been over 5 years.
Okay, wow. And is your background just in regular development or something else, or how did you go from not Kubernetes to Kubernetes?
Yeah, I think for me, I've been in, you know, tech game for about 15 plus years, and I started out as a system administrator. There's a long history of things before that. And I spent time as a software developer and open source, whether it's my own projects or working at a company like Puppet Labs that was just really deep in the open source world, maybe about 8 years ago. And I've also worked in the enterprise, right? So I've worked in financial institutions. I've worked at ISPs, web hosting, worked in data centers before. But if you take all of that experience of building and shipping software, you also know that there's a lot of things that happens below the software line, right? So when you build an application, it has to run somewhere. And all the activities that go into distributing those applications and making the run, Kubernetes kind of represents that checkpoint. So when I was working at CoreOS, we were building a lot of tools around the container ecosystem. So everyone's probably heard of, you know, Docker, you know, package your application in a container and use Docker to run it. But once you introduce a bunch of machines, you need some orchestration, right? You need something that will manage those applications across multiple servers. And that's where Kubernetes comes in. So it kind of represented this problem in some ways introduced by containers, but it's a problem we've always had when you start to think about managing applications across multiple machines.
Okay. I was listening to what you just said, and I wasn't able to totally keep up, partially because I have to admit that I still don't understand Docker very much. I have never really used it. And so, like, I've used it in the sense that I've, like, installed it on my machine. I've Dockerized a couple applications. I even got a Dockerized application working on EC2 on one occasion. But I've never, like, worked somewhere where that was, like, part of the work that we did. And so I don't completely understand the problem that Docker solves yet. I understand that, like, supposedly it solves the problem of, like, well, it works on my machine, and it's like, okay, I can get that. But do you think you could help me a little bit understand Docker better?
Yeah, so I think an analogy helps. If you were trying to deliver let's say a neighbor wanted to borrow, like, your toaster, and they live across the street from you, you would just unplug the toaster and walk across the street. Let's say a friend in another state wanted to borrow your toaster. You totally could get in your car, put the toaster in your back seat, and drive it to your friend and then drive back. And that analogy is kind of how people ship software manually, or even their scripts, right? Like, they have built their own automation tools. They have their own ways of doing it. But let's say you want to scale that out so that everyone in the world could ship whatever they wanted to anyone else. So you have to think about a few standards. So first, we need a common way of working. Not everyone's going to have a car. Not everyone's going to be able to have the storage necessary to ship, let's say, a refrigerator. So you're going to have to think about all of those different items you want to ship in a different way. Now, if you go to, let's say, FedEx or UPS, and you bring in your toaster, what's the first thing they're going to ask you to do?
I don't know. I've never shipped a toaster or very anything. Much stuff at all.
So normally they'll tell you, you probably need to put that in a box because we don't want to handle your loose items, right? Like, we don't want to be responsible for that thing bouncing around. So what you need to do is put that in the box, and if it's fragile, you need to put some protection around it, and then we need you to seal the box because we don't want to open it. We just want to ship it to its destination. And then what we'll do is we'll ask you, where does it need to go? And we'll put a label on it. And that way, I can, if I'm FedEx, if I'm UPS, I can ship anything from anyone, anywhere, consistently and repeatedly, right? Now, let's map that analogy to the software world. Today, people write code in Python, toasters, Java, refrigerators, and different people have different tools for packaging those. In the Python world, you may use something like pip. In the Java world, you may use something like a WAR file. And then how you distribute those things, you may be writing your own bash scripts, the bicycle, or maybe you have to ship it on an airplane. And this would be something more of your heavyweight tools, maybe like Puppet, Chef, or Ansible. But either way, you're going to have your own way of packaging and distributing that software. And a lot of times it's going to depend on the language. So usually in that kind of development environment, you're a developer, you have the right version of Java on your computer, you have the right dependencies on your computer, and you test and it works on your machine. And then you package up the WAR file and you give it to someone else. And they say, hey, this doesn't work on my machine because they're missing the dependencies. You didn't tell them to put it in a box. So Docker represents the box. Docker says, look, there's a million ways of packaging software. There's all of these programming languages. We're going to simplify things. You have to put it in a box. And the box in this case is a tarball or zip file, if people are more familiar with something like that. But the goal is, whether you're writing Python, Node.js, Java, it just doesn't matter. You're going to put all of your dependencies in the box. And the way you're going to do that is you make a Docker file, and a Docker file says, put this in there, put this in there, put that in there. And it looks like a bash script to most people, but at the end result, you'll have this kind of universal box that we call a container image. And now that you have a standard format, you can now put it on any of the shipping tools. So if someone has Docker on their machine, they don't need to have a long discussion with you about Java versus Python or getting the machine to look like your laptop. Because everything is in the box, they can just now run it. That's the beauty of Docker, right? So Docker now gives you this way of saying, package your application, store it in a container registry, and then anyone else running Docker can just pull it down and run it without thinking about all those other things.
That makes a lot of sense. And that's probably the best explanation I've heard of Docker so far. So thanks for that. I think in a lot of the situations I've had, like, the problems that Docker solves aren't the problems that I've encountered yet at the stage my application is at and at the stage the team is at. Like, for example, in my current position, I'm the only developer at the company, and our production environment is just two EC2 instances on AWS. And so it seems to me that Docker wouldn't really get me that much in that situation, because I never need to, like, put my application on somebody else's computer. I don't have very complicated hosting needs. And so I'm probably just not there yet in the place where Docker would help me. Does that seem right?
Oh, this is perfect. So you're the person and scenario we often describe to say, do you need this tool or not? So I would say one thing, maybe you don't need Kubernetes, okay? So Kubernetes tries to deal with this whole packaging problem and distribution at much broader scale, or especially when there's multiple teams or multiple types of applications involved. Now, let's take your particular case. you're right. You know everything there is to know about your application stack. You only have two EC2 instances. You know everything about that part. The cloud provider is taking care of some of the infrastructure for you. Like, you're in this kind of great position. Now, you leave. Aha! Someone's going to have to try to reverse engineer what the hell you were thinking, right? Maybe you're deploying things manually. Maybe you had a special process that you went about doing things. Or maybe they just got lucky where you're the type of person who can do both roles fairly decently. Now, the next person that comes along will have to try to figure out why you chose to do the way things the way you did. And let's say the runtime is outdated. Let's say you're using like an old version of Python or something. They're going to spend a lot of time trying to catch up to the decisions you've made, and they're going to have to live with them, right? So there's going to be a ramp-up period because they don't know what you're doing. Hopefully you wrote it down. But let's say even as a solo developer, you say, you know what? Instead of me copying my application to these machines, if I install Docker, then at least what I could do is say on my laptop, I'll keep my existing workflow. I'm not going to change everything because it's working for me. But what I'll do is I'll just do this extra step. I'll just do a Docker build and also check in that Docker file. And when I do software releases, what I'll do then is say, I'll create that container image. Now, what does that do for you? You can continue to use EC2. So you have those two machines in EC2 and you put Docker on them. So now your deployment process is just going to be Docker pull, Docker run. Great, that's pretty standard. Let's say you go from two machines to 50 machines. Docker pull, Docker run. You hire a new person that's worked with Docker at another company. Docker pull, Docker run. There's another thing that you get. A lot of the platforms as a service. So some people would say a person like you with only two virtual machines might be better off with the serverless platform, like Cloud Run, ECS in the Amazon world. And in that case, you can get rid of the VMs and let it run your Docker containers for you. And you're going to end up with the same results you're probably getting from those two VMs. So the things that you get from adopting containers, even at a small scale as a solo developer, you start to adopt some standards around what you're doing, right? You probably do the same for your libraries, right? So if you're making a web request, you could write your own HTTP library, but you don't because there's a standard library that other people know how to use and it's well tested than creating your own.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, me and my boss have talked at least once about what happens if I die. Like I go and I find a poisonous mushroom in my yard and eat it, and then I die the next day. What do we do? They would be pretty much screwed. And so we still don't have a great solution for that right now because a lot of stuff is just in my head. There's like passwords that I only know and stuff like that. And so it's probably, it's definitely not good the way we have things right now. And so,
that's where I think something like Docker would help you just a little bit. I'm not saying go all in with the Kubernetes stuff. You don't need to go all in, right? You could just start with, you know what? Let me at least get containers so that way it's easy to deploy, whether they want to go serverless or stick with these VMs. At least I'm not trapping them into my custom process. And in terms of like the files or secrets, yeah, you should probably store those in like some kind of secrets database. There's lots of offerings out there. But these are things that even though it seems like they're designed for bigger enterprises or teams that are much bigger, they allow you that continuity and reassurance.
Yeah. Okay. So like I'm having a thought and tell me if this seems like something that makes sense or not. So it seems to me that I could at a very minimum just Dockerize my application. And even if I never even actually do anything with that Docker image, I have a benefit there because the next person who comes along, they could use that Docker image to get the application up and running on their machine, even if I don't use it for anything else in production or anything like that. Does that seem like it would be helpful?
I like that as a option, right? Some people go too far with that where you have to have Docker in order to spin it up on your machine. I think that's going a little too far. I think having the option of your application working well in Docker is really great to have as a way to kind of make it easy to onboard new people or even change providers or platforms if the time ever came.
if I have an application that's Dockerized, and let's say I have a fresh machine, fresh laptop, I install the Dockerized application on my computer. I guess I pull the Docker image, and then I don't know the terminology, but I install the application using that Docker image. Am I then like locked in with Docker, and I have to do all my commands through Docker because I don't really have like, I'm a Rails guy, so let's say it's a Ruby on Rails application, but my computer for whatever reason doesn't have Ruby or whatever. I imagine I'm going to have to run all my commands through Docker and have that, like, in my experience, there's some performance overhead, which is a little bit annoying. Is there any way to like get out of that so I can just, is it clear what I'm like?
It's super clear. It's super clear. And actually, the way you describe working is the way I work. So I don't have Docker on my machine at all. So when I'm creating things, the analogy I like to use here, if we were making a movie, we would want to work with our camera, our IDE, the thing we write code in. And when we are recording with our camera, we don't really care about VHS tapes or DVDs or Blu-ray disc, right? Like we're not at that stage. We just want to capture our video and our audio. And in our editor, we would edit the video and we will keep it in that format until it's ready to go. And once it's ready to go, then we think about exporting it into some movie file, or maybe we burn it to a Blu-ray, right? That's the last mile. So the way I like to think about Docker is, if I'm going to just consume an application, meaning that I'm not going to be working on it, maybe that I'm working on the app that depends on another app, I might bring in that other app or database on Docker. So I would say Docker pull MySQL, Docker run MySQL. So I don't really have to install MySQL and worry about, you know, messing up my local machine with the wrong versions. And then as I'm writing my other app, well, I'm probably going to do that outside of Docker, right? In my case. So I would install Ruby on my laptop, you know, get that set up the way I like, and I can have that speed of development, right? Make a change, run it again, make a change, run it again. But then when I'm ready to update maybe how it's packaged, I may update the Docker file. And then when I check it in, I may have my CI/CD system build the Docker image and store it in the registry. So that way, you see what I mean? So it's the last mile. It's a packaging format, not necessarily a developer workflow. And some people would disagree with me on that. Some people would say, nope, Docker should be part of, when you hit save, it should just build a new container and run it. That's just not the way I work. And I prefer using Docker as a last mile consumption technology.
Well, you answered another question that I had in my head, but I didn't ask yet, which is this. I would have a fear. Okay, so I grab the Docker image and I'm using my Rails application through Docker the whole time. But then let's say I get tired of having the overhead of Docker and I say, this has Ruby 2.6.3. I'm going to install Ruby 2.6.3 on my machine and just use it locally. And I'll do the same thing with everything else that I need. But then let's say that I decide to upgrade my Ruby version later. And maybe I'm not really thinking about it too closely. And so I upgrade Ruby to Ruby 2.7 on my machine, but I neglect to keep my machine and Docker in sync. And maybe it's that way. Maybe it's the other way around. Either way, some way the two get out of sync. And my fear would be that there wouldn't be a way to enforce the syncing of the local machines and the Docker image. But what you just said answered that question for me, which is you would perform your build on the CI system. And so it seems like that CI build, by Dockerizing it, would force any problems that arise due to a getting out of sync. It would arise in CI, and so you wouldn't be able to have those problems for very long. Am I thinking about that right?
I'm going to tell you something even better. And you may are. So if you use Ruby, I used to write a lot of Ruby when I was at Puppet Labs. And we used to use like RVM because sometimes different apps needed different versions of libraries or even different versions of Ruby. So that's a real pain. But RVM, you know, you can kind of work around it. The nice thing about Docker is this. Let's say version 1.0 of your app needs like Ruby 2.4 for some reason. Okay. So, or 1.8.7. Let's just go back. 1.8.7. And in your Docker file, you typically can import a base image. So your base image is kind of like a layer. And that layer will probably have just all the common stuff that you would find in like RVM, like Ruby 1.8.7 and a couple of standard libraries that you use. So you would say, all right, Dockerfile, I want for this version of the app, 1.0, I want to bring in Ruby 1.8.7. And then I want you to install the app, all my source code in the right place because that's how Ruby works. And then, hey, this is how you start my app. And then, boom, you do a Docker build and out spits this container image, aka Tarball. Great. Now, you're writing 2.0 of your app, and you want to go to Ruby 2.8 or something. Now, the nice thing about this is that fully baked thing that you built last time is always going to install with 1.8.7 baked in. And you can now work on Ruby 2.0 inside of your new application. And the beauty thing about this is when you install both apps on the same server, one will run with 1.8.7 in full isolation, and the other one will run with Ruby 2.x in full isolation. So you can roll forward and back atomically.
Okay. Yeah, so it sounds like it's maybe not that easy to shoot yourself in the foot with getting things out of sync.
Yeah, it's a little easier. I mean, you do need to keep track of, like, if you have a base image and there's security vulnerabilities in there, you may need to rebuild that Docker image by like updating the version of Ruby. So maybe you got to go from 1.86 to 1.87. But you can do that kind of when you feel like it, right? So the whole point of this is whatever you do on your laptop for that next version, you can update that Docker file to encapsulate all the changes you need. So that way you can put it all in the box and not worry about breaking the stuff that you packaged and shipped before.
Okay. All right, so we've talked a good amount about Docker and use cases and how it's beneficial and all that stuff. What about Kubernetes? How do I know when, or what pain might I have that Kubernetes can alleviate?
Yeah, so let's say you got those two EC2 instances and you adopt Docker. So life's pretty good now. You're starting to package your apps and you're not really fighting the configuration of the server as much anymore because all your stuff is fairly self-contained. So that's great. And now you introduce 200 servers across two different zones. So the first thing you may be thinking is maybe I'll go find an automation tool and I'll write some scripts that deploys it to the 200 servers. And then I'll learn about auto-scaling groups in AWS because I don't want to have 200 machines running all the time. I want to scale down at night to maybe 30. And, oh, I got to integrate into the load balancer because those machines will come and go. So you're going to learn all of this stuff, right? Maybe you bring in some Terraform. You start bringing in all of these tools to try to help you manage all of this, right? And you're still going to have some gaps. You won't necessarily have a clear opinion on how you want to handle your logging, metrics. You're not going to have a clear opinion like if a machine were to die in production, can I just move the app to another machine that is healthy? So there's all kind of things you have to think about when you're dealing with like a distributed system in that way. And again, a lot of companies over time before Kubernetes, you kind of built all that stuff by hand. So now what you can do is say, you know what? There's a lot of people who have been doing this for a very long time. And a lot of those people, Red Hat, Google, Microsoft, so many companies out there have been contributing to this thing called Kubernetes. And the way I like to think about Kubernetes is if you took like 10, 20 people that had a really solid operations background and they were to build out a platform that everyone else could use, what would they build? And Kubernetes kind of represents that. So in this world, it would be, okay, I was using Docker directly before, but now I have to layer all this other stuff on top. What if I just layer Kubernetes on top when I need it, when I kind of have that scale complexity issue, and then use the Kubernetes API, and then Kubernetes represents a slightly different workflow. You'll still use Docker to build your containers, but then you can do something slightly different. You can say, hey, Kubernetes, I'm going to give you all the machines, right? I'm not going to worry about that part anymore. You can have them all, and Kubernetes will say, great. You just tell me how many of each container you want running and I'll figure out which machines they run on, what zone or what region, and I'll put them in the load balancer for you. Just one tool. And the last thing here is, since Kubernetes is the standard way of doing this, if you go hire someone off the street that knows Ruby on Rails and you tell them, hey, we're using Ruby on Rails, they would probably at least know how to get started or start looking in the right places. The same is true with Kubernetes. If you told me that you're managing 200 machines, but you were doing it with Kubernetes, then I don't have to come through and learn all of the custom scripts you've written, try to reverse engineer what you were thinking. Oh, that's Kubernetes. I know what to do.
I can see how that would be beneficial. Obviously, the people listening who use Rails will understand the benefit of having something that looks the same no matter where it's applied. So my production setup right now is, well, let's pretend that it's a little bit different, because it actually used to be until recently. Let's say instead of just having two EC2 instances, a web instance and a worker instance, let's say I had like five web instances, and maybe let's forget about the worker instance. Let's just say I had five web instances. In front of that, I have an elastic load balancer, and then I have a target group that's pointed at those five EC2 instances. And my particular problem right now is that I'm using Ansible to provision my EC2 instances. So I don't have Snowflake servers, which, for the listener's benefit, if you're not familiar with Snowflake servers, it's how we did it in the old days, which is you have a blank Ubuntu machine on some hosting provider, and you manually install whatever you need installed. You manually set up your production application, and then that's that. But unfortunately, what if that server dies? What if you want to create another identical server? You don't know how it's configured, because all that configuration was done manually and it's invisible. So fortunately, I don't have that, because I have that all in Ansible. But what I still don't have is I have a Snowflake production configuration, because I manually set up this load balancer and all this related stuff. I understand that one of my options is I could use some kind of infrastructure as code tool like Terraform, and that's kind of in my plans for the future. If I were to use Kubernetes and, let's say, ECS, Elastic Container Service, how much of that would be irrelevant now that I'm using Kubernetes? Or would all that same stuff still be necessary? It would just be Kubernetes, I don't know the term, but I would have containers in ECS instead of EC2 instances. What would be the same? What would be different?
So here's what's starting to happen. When you talk about the cloud, you don't really see the hypervisors, right? You just say, give me a virtual machine, and a lot goes on under the covers, and up pops a virtual machine. And the problem is, no one really wants a virtual machine when you talk about it from the lens of an application developer. You just want something to run your application. So me giving you a raw Linux server means that you just have to do a bunch of work like Ansible and all this other glue stuff to get it ready to run the application. What you really want is something that gets you closer to just run my application. So on the extreme end of it, you can talk of PaaS like Heroku, right? Here is my app, Heroku. You just run it for me. And there's limitations to Heroku, right? It can't run any app in the world. Maybe it doesn't really support the database you need, or maybe you have to do some customization where it just doesn't work for you. Okay. So then if we step one below that, another way of thinking about this, instead of having virtual machines be the kind of focal point, what if we made the application the focal point? So then what you do is you have a different API. So if you're using AWS or whatever tools you're using, you say, hey, AWS, create me a virtual machine. Got it. Then use Ansible to configure it this way. Got it. In the Kubernetes and containers world, we don't do much configuration of the VM at all, because everything's inside of the container. So we need less configuration management of the underlying host, because we never plan to put anything there. All of our configuration files, we can store those in Kubernetes, and Kubernetes will deliver them and inject them in the container at runtime, and we can get into the details of that later. So what changes now is that you have a different API. So the Kubernetes API will give you, let's talk about specifically for your use case. So for your use case, if all you were doing is kind of running web apps and even workers, that's cool because Kubernetes gets even more powerful when you have different type of apps. And then all you want to do is have the workers attached to a load balancer automatically. So when they come and when they go, the load balancer is updated automatically. That use case is just there by default in Kubernetes. So let's say you click the button and out pops a fully managed Kubernetes cluster for you. Now you can do things like, hey, I already have a container. I'm going to create what we call a deployment inside of Kubernetes. And it's looked like a YAML file, but you'll say something like, I want 10 copies of this, and I want to use this specific container version, 1.0, and you'll call kubectl apply and give it that YAML file. And then the Kubernetes API will say, I got it from here. I know how to distribute these on these machines. And the last step to that would be Kubernetes create a service. So there'd be another YAML file that says, I would like to attach those containers in that deployment by name to a load balancer. And then Kubernetes will be smart enough. And here's the real power. Regardless if you're running on Google Cloud, AWS, or Azure, or maybe even your own machine with Minikube, you can create a service and then Kubernetes will typically figure out, oh, this is Amazon. Let me create an ELB and then do all the right things to make sure that those containers are attached if they're healthy. So all of that is built in by default. So it seems way easier. And guess what? I didn't mention Ansible, Terraform, or any other scripting. Most of that functionality just comes out of the box in the Kubernetes world.
Because all that kind of stuff, like load balancing, is stuff that you're probably going to want no matter what platform you're using and that kind of stuff.
That's exactly right, because we know over the last 15 years, these are the patterns. Like, I need a config file. I need to create a load balancer. I even need to mount storage sometimes. Kubernetes can also help you with that. So a lot of those things that you see at the typical infrastructure layer is just baked in, and each cloud provider has its own integration, so it's super native, right? And it's just something that we figured as an industry, there's no reason for people to keep doing that over and over again. Let's bake it in and provide higher level APIs so you can just consume those services.
Okay, well, I'm feeling inspired right now because I've been kind of feeling my way forward in the dark a little bit, because in this position I'm in now, I'm for the first time responsible for everything to do with hosting. And it's small scale, luckily. If you're going to put somebody as inexperienced as me in charge of production infrastructure, good thing it's small scale. But there's so many options. There's like infinite options. Do I use Terraform, Ansible, Puppet, Chef, Kubernetes, Docker, some combination of all those things? What do I do? And this is clarifying it a lot. Like Kubernetes kind of makes a lot of that stuff. I don't know if I would say it makes it unnecessary, but I really like the idea of Kubernetes being like a standard path where you don't need to do a whole bunch of custom stuff that's unique to your production configuration. There's just stuff that's, like you say, people have been doing this kind of stuff for a long time. There are certain things that are common to the vast majority of production setups. Just do it their way. Let Kubernetes set it all up its way and don't do it all yourself.
Yeah, and that's why people use Rails, right? Like, you could try to write a whole website using just raw Ruby in the standard library and reinvent all of that stuff. Or you could use something like Sinatra and it gives you a little bit more helpers. But sometimes you're like, I'm just building the CRUD app or something. Stop playing around. Import Ruby on Rails. Use the ORM and just get the app off the ground, right? Like, if you start to really go past that, which you can go really far with Ruby on Rails. So I think for a lot of companies, that makes sense. So if you look at Kubernetes more like the Rails way, like, there's a tons of ways I can do this by just taking the raw pieces, EC2 instances, LBs, and doing it myself. Or that would be the Sinatra approach. Or you go more of the Ruby on Rails approach, but that means you have to conform a little bit. Now, keep in mind, Ruby on Rails is extensible, right? You can make different and swap out different components yourself. Same is true of Kubernetes. You're not going to be 100% locked in, which is why people like it. And last thing here, even though I like Kubernetes, it solves a lot of problems. I would suggest anyone that's kind of starting out, especially kind of at your scale, if you get to a container image, using that packaging and shipping analogy, once you put it in the box, then you can either drive the box yourself, you can go to FedEx or UPS, and that box will work for all three, right? That's a good place to be in, because in your case, if I was coming from like 2 to 10 machines, I probably would try something like serverless. So if you're in Amazon, that's going to be Fargate. If you're in Google Cloud, that's going to be like Cloud Run. Or if you're in something like Heroku, right? So each of those platforms are going to take the same container images, and you don't have to deal with any of this Kubernetes stuff or any of this infrastructure stuff at all. And when the time comes, you can just reuse that container if you just really want to do it yourself and not have to repackage your application.
What's the difference between ECS and Fargate?
So ECS came earlier. So ECS was basically a response to this whole, everyone has a bunch of containers, how do you manage it situation that we described earlier. So ECS has a very simple interface, like give me your container and I'll run it across EC2 instances for you. But you kind of have a concept of a cluster exposed to you, right? And all right, there's a few moving pieces with that. Now, Fargate basically says, what if you were able to hide a lot of the cluster aspects, right? So for ECS, you may say, give me a 3-node cluster. And you got 3 machines, and you know, you think about the machines and you can scale them up or down, and you can scale your app up and down on top of that. But ECS says, or Fargate says, well, let's get rid of the machines. If you tell me you want 3 containers, I'll go create 3 machines if I need to, or I might just create 2 and just run the 3 apps on those 2 machines. So the goal is just to eliminate the concept of a cluster, right? Like you don't really care about a cluster as a developer. You just care more about run my apps. And if you need more capacity, add it to the mix.
I see. Okay. And if you were to set up Kubernetes on AWS today, would you prefer to use Fargate over ECS?
I would say for you just starting out, I would truly recommend you start with Fargate. Now, there's a big cost difference sometimes, but I think the cost is worth it. Because in many cases, even if you have a fully managed Kubernetes instance, right? Let's say you click a button and they have a thing called EKS, which is their Kubernetes service. And it's a little bit different. So in Google Cloud, where I work, we have a thing called GKE, Google's Container Service Engine. And it works a lot like Fargate in many ways because everything is kind of fully managed for you. But here's the thing. If I give you a cluster, let's say I give you Kubernetes 1.14. And if there's a security situation, you still need to go and update that infrastructure under the covers. You got to go back to the Google Cloud Console and say, hey, I want to either turn on auto upgrades or upgrade to the newest version like 1.16. Okay. But you're still kind of thinking about infrastructure a little bit, a lot less than you are now. But it's still there. And you know how expectations reset once you're used to something. Now, my guess is, myself included, I don't really care about infrastructure that much, especially if I'm not doing something super custom. And in that world, I would just prefer to use something like Fargate because in your case, Fargate, since you're on AWS, is going to say, let's just focus on your containers. We're going to give you an API to connect it to load balancers and all of that stuff. And they have a Fargate for Kubernetes. So if you like the Kubernetes style API, because you want to preserve some of that knowledge that people may have, it's also a standard. So then you just click the Fargate button and what you get back is something that just looks like a Kubernetes API without ever worrying about the cluster.
Okay. That makes sense. So it seems like if I'm going to hop off this call and go try out Kubernetes and give it a go on my infrastructure, maybe the way to go would be with Fargate. Now, if I'm using Kubernetes, do I have to use some kind of containerization like Docker? Is that just part of the picture?
Yeah, so that's that analogy, right? If you go to FedEx, they're going to ask you to put it in a box. And I think it's a worthy exercise because I visit a lot of companies every year. And one of the biggest challenges they have is that there are so many ways to build the different applications. And some of them have been neglected over time and no one knows how to really build them efficiently. So I think as a developer, going through the exercise of creating a Docker file is going to give you a repeatable packaging and build process. And even if there's no one else that comes after you, I think you will appreciate it, you know, 6 months from now. Let's say the company wants to move to Google Cloud. And if you start using containers and Kubernetes, well, it's not going to be a big redo of everything. It's like, oh, I'll just use their Kubernetes versus trying to figure out how to update your Ansible scripts and your Terraform and all that other stuff.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, in the last few minutes of our talk, I want to switch gears completely and ask you about something else. I've seen you tweeting about this, and it's an area of interest of mine, and I would love to hear you talk about it a little more. And that topic is microservices versus monoliths. And my opinion, which it seems like is shared by you too. I don't remember what you were tweeting now because it's been a while since I looked at it. But I think it makes a lot of sense for almost any application to start with a monolith. And then maybe someday for like 1% or 0.1% of applications, it'll make sense for you to transition to microservices later on. But it's certainly not my opinion that monoliths are the old, outdated, bad way, and microservices are the new, modern, good way. It's just not like that. What's your take on the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, you're spot on. So I think introducing the concept of a microservice made people start calling regular applications monoliths. You know what I mean? It's like you don't know to call something different until a new name arrives. And in that situation, all we're doing is building services, right? Like that's all we're doing. We're building apps. And these days, applications usually have an API, like a REST API or something like that. And it is so much simpler to just take everything that you need, all the routes, all the paths, and just put them in one code base and then create one binary or one container and deploy it. And for most people in the world, like you said, 99%+, they're going to do fine with that, right? And be done. Now, here's the thing. Sometimes you're going to need to write another application. Maybe that worker code, you found a framework in a different programming language like Rust or Golang, and it does exactly what you want. So then you say, let's write the worker in Go. So that's a natural new service. Now you could step back and say, oh, am I doing microservices now? It's like, well, not really. You just have another service doing something else, but it's not necessarily a microservice architecture that you're going for. Now, here's the thing. Most people can get by with monoliths. There are challenges with monoliths, especially when you start working with multiple developers, right? You start to cram all your logic in the same place. And without a framework like Ruby on Rails, you can make a mess really quickly, right? People don't have a standard in terms of write your functionality and then map a route to it, right? So once you run into that area, you have to make a trade-off. Do you say, is my organizational complexity so high that we should start thinking about each team having their own Ruby on Rails app and all of their functionality is encapsulated there? And when we went too far as an industry, while that makes sense to a lot of people, some people said, well, even within that team, everything that could be considered a service should also run in its own deployable. And now you kind of end up in a mess because now you have to glue these things back together, because at some point, some app is going to have a dependency on 3 or 4, 5, 6, 100 different things. And it's going to be a nightmare to test and keep all that stuff in sync.
Indeed. Indeed. Okay. Yeah, I think you and I we're on the same page regarding this. But I feel like it's a PSA that is great to repeat a lot, because there's a common belief among developers, I think, that old equals outdated and new equals modern and good, and that we should discard the old in favor of the new. And sometimes that's true. It's definitely true sometimes, but not always.
Yeah, think about your future self. You will be older in 10 years. Should we do away with you? Doesn't make sense, right? You'll be hopefully a better person over time. So I think we have to pay homage to when something lasts long enough for us to hate it. You have to step back and say, look, there's a lot of maturity that it takes to stand the test of time, especially when there's so many new things coming and going. that for things to persist for 20 years, there's something to that, and we should give more credit when that happens.
That's very true, and I think that's a great place to end it. Kelsey, where can people go to find more about you online?
I have lots of videos on YouTube, so if you do Kelsey Hightower and some topic, maybe I have a video there. And I spend a lot of time on social media, maybe not a lot, but I do share my thoughts at Kelsey Hightower on Twitter, and my DMs are open, so people jump in there and you can ask me a question, and more than likely I'll respond.
Kelsey, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.